continue with that today and perhaps get into the next subject matter. I can warn you ahead of time, in the earlier session this morning, we didn't get beyond the West of Eden segment, so we'll see what happens. We take up today with the Tower of Babel story in Genesis 11. I do have a fair amount of humor back home in Indiana that's perfect for warming up on the Tower of Babel, because every final exam week, the Tower of Babel lives. I run into all sorts of things allegedly in the English language that I am unable to interpret. While people are writing rapidly under great stress and attempting to make themselves clear, other things that amuse one or perplex one appear in typed manuscripts, and even things that spell checkers have attempted to fix. But the funniest things come in final exams, and I have a whole sheaf of things back home called gaffes in a file that I wish I had brought, but I didn't. I'll have to just try and remember a few of them. I was sharing some of these last week because I found a sheet in a file that I had with me that had a few of them on. Some new words that were invented. The Gospel of Mark I shared last week, I learned from a student not too long ago. Its very rapid pace was described by a student this way: the Gospel of Mark was written vibraciously. And I think that's rather a good word, and I may end up trying to coin it. The word that seems to be most troublesome in the kind of things that I receive is the word crucifixion. You not believe how many ways I have seen that word spelled. A very common one is crucifixion, crucifition. I don't know whether there's an attempt there to speak to the historicity question or what. Very common to read it cruxify, C-R-U-X-I-F-Y, cruxification, I have seen it that way, crucifixion, it's amazing how many ways you can crucify, crucifixion. A colleague of mine has one that's kind of a classic back in my department. He teaches things on marriage and family and received a term paper with a typo. This is not a final exam mistake, but it spoke of how Christians living under grace can engage in sexual intimacy without feelings of quilt. There's something to think about. And another classic was from a colleague who was using Death of a Salesman as a part of a text in a theology course of some kind, and a student wrote on an exam how Willie Loman's sort of outward displays of courage were merely a facade, P-H-S-O-D. You do the best you can in the finals. Anyway, I'll let go of this at this point. I also have a daughter who's almost three, so I know the Tower of Babel lives right in my home as well. I'd have to do a lot of interpreting. We saw a sequence of stories beginning in Genesis 2 and 3, which have a similar outline, I was trying to point out. In the story of eating the forbidden fruit, the story of a brother murdering in an act of jealousy his younger brother, and in the story of the flood, there is a sequence of some sort of wrongdoing which God discovers or observes, to which God responds by inflicting a curse. But in each case, God finds a way to keep this whole thing going and even provides the human beings in each case something which will allow them now to cope with the consequences of what's happened. So at the end of the story of eating the forbidden fruit and discovering that they were naked, God sews leather clothes for the people to cover their shame. When vengeance has been, or the possibility of vengeance has been unleashed in the world in the Cain and Abel story, not only does God not kill the killer, but marks the killer so that no one else will try to get revenge either. And in the flood story, God determines at the end that it doesn't work. You can nuke everybody but the best few folks you can find, and you'll still end up with the same problem you began with. And so curse, punishment simply doesn't work to solve the problem. But now that people have seen what a total nuking might look like, and might be in fear of that forever, God offers a covenant, a promise that so long as things continue, seed time and harvest, summer and winter will follow in an order. And then God establishes a covenant with Noah, which in effect sets up an orderly world that people can rely on. So God doggedly persists in keeping this project alive that God has begun in creation, even though the human beings continually mess things up. Chapter 11 is the next narrative. There is more genealogy in chapter 10, the genealogy of Noah, because we need to see how the world is repopulated. Then chapter 11, if we could pick it up there, speaks of the whole earth having one language with the same words, people migrating from the east, coming upon a plain in the land of Shinar, saying to one another, "Come, let's make bricks, burn them thoroughly." They had brick for stone, bitumen for mortar. And they say, "Come, let's build a city with a tower reaching into the heavens to make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered on the face of the earth." And as we'll see, that's something that God disapproves of, storming the heavens by means of a tower. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which mortals have built. And the Lord said, "Would you look at that? They are one people with one language. This is only the start of what they'll do. Nothing they think up will be impossible. Let's go down there and confuse their language so they won't understand each other's talk, okay?" So the Lord did. Scattered them abroad over the face of the earth, and they left off building the city. And so the place is called Babel, because there the Lord Babelized the language. A little punning going on in Hebrew. Scattered them over the face of all the earth. And then we're back to genealogies. So that story is in the same literary mode as the previous stories. God is very anthropomorphically described, coming to check things out, discussing it, thinking about it, talking about it, coming up with a response. And so we have at least three parts of the same sequence. A sin, or whatever we want to call it, a behavior that merits a response from God. God comes and discovers or checks it out and responds with what appears to be a curse. That is, God foils the plans, messes things up for those who are engaged in this project. But there's no fourth part at this point anyway. The story leaves off with a description that accounts for the world as we know it, namely with people of every kind scattered all over the place, unable to understand each other, and therefore unable to work together on any kind of project where the world might demonstrate its unity, its cooperativeness. In one way, for sure, this is what scholars of ancient literature refer to as an etiology, an explanation of things, how things came to be the way they are. Why is it that there are so many languages? Well, because once upon a time God confused all the languages because of what people were doing when they could understand each other. And so it may be that that's a way that the story gets into the tradition as an etiology of how things came to be. But it plays another role, I think, in Genesis. It's another story that fits in this mold of sin, discovery, and curse, except that the fourth part is missing. If we look for the fourth part, we have to go all the way through more genealogies, beginning in verse 10, which take us to the end of that chapter.
Can I ask a question about verse 1?
Sure.
The whole earth has one language, and is it safe to assume that what that means is that people understand one another? Is that a utopian vision at work there? And if so, is that something that ancient peoples in general thought of as the perfect world, one where people could understand one another? Or is this just unique to this story in the Bible?
That's a wonderfully interesting and complex question, and there's a fair amount of debate among biblical scholars about that. And to just get ahead a little bit in response, the way people read that nowadays as a utopia or a, what's the opposite of a utopia, a dystopia? Whether you see that as a utopia or a dystopia has to do with your view of pluralism. Yes, there were ancient peoples, among them the fellow I mentioned yesterday, Alexander the Great, who believed that utopia could only exist where there was one language and one culture and one religion and the unity of that kind. And it had to come into being even if you had to force it. There is even in the Christian tradition a leaning toward that when there is talk of a kind of unity in which everyone will be absolutely identical in their language of whatever, praise and so forth. There is a remnant of the utopianism monolithism? There are others who take this story and see it as a fixing of dystopia, that there will always be in a situation of no pluralism and everybody being the same, a form of idolatry, which this story epitomizes. If you are the only kind, it's too easy to think that you are God, or that you have all the answers, or that there is only one viewpoint on things, and so it's too easy to become, to fall for fetishes and idolatry. And the only way you can be saved from fetishizing and idolatry is for there to be pluralism. And so there are those who read Genesis 11 as God actually fixing things by eliminating the possibility of only having one way to understand things.
Fred, God's the one here who says, now they'll be able to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, what would God's view or the Lord's view of this?
Well, that's the very argument that the people who see unity as dystopia use, that God cannot tolerate. You know, this is an awful thing that these people have, you know, this one language that they'll try anything in their imagination now, or because of this.
Isn't this what's happening though now? You know, the world politically is fractionalizing, but economically it's going back into one language and unity. So does that mean that God's going to have to do this again?
Yeah, I don't know. Last hour somebody brought up the fact that in a certain way computer languages are becoming the universal language, and someone was saying that 0101, everyone can understand. Yes. But I hasten to add, not me. I can run a computer, but I have no idea what's in there, or do not understand how it works. It's voodoo. Anyway. Yeah, that's a very interesting thing to think about. You know, it's... The history of human dreams for fixing things often do revolve around similarity and difference, plurality and unity. I have been presenting the story as though they are moving from it's not critical whether they're moving from a remnant of utopia and are now cursed with plurality, but that's sort of how I presented it, as people doing something because of something good that they had, which God then has to break by means of a curse. But for what I was attempting, the crucial thing is that the fourth element is missing.
Mm-hmm. The thought just occurred to me that when communism controlled Russia, that was a utopia type of thing. They were forcing all these different people into one pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And look what's happened when it dissolved. Then you've got dystopia. Is that sort of what has happened there, in a sense? You said that Alexander the Great said even if it had to be forced, he thought that was utopia.
Yeah. Well, there you have a primary example of the, I guess, the advantages and disadvantages of both. You know, Alexander the Great was faced with exactly what Eastern Europe is facing now. You know, what are you going to do about Serbs and Croats? Well, you say, sorry guys, but you can't have either. What you want, you'll have what I want. And we'll all have one thing, and it worked for a while under the Seleucids, the main heirs of Alexander's dream, at least in that part of the Mediterranean world, but it fell apart. You know. But for a time, some of those people quit fighting with each other. Yeah, I don't know, we could...
Could this provide a map for understanding how controversies have gone over the last 20 years? I'm thinking of the premillennialists, for example, who argue against any vision of world unity, and their chief enemies are the United Nations and the World Council of Churches, on the grounds that if they bring world unity, then they'll open the door for the Antichrist and the building of the Tower of Babel. So they want pluralism. Then you've got Secondly, the liberal ideal that we've had since the Enlightenment, that world understanding is what will bring people together and create world peace, and that's what underlies the United Nations. And that also underlied the World Council of Churches after the Second World War. But now you got the third view, which is a new generation of liberal view, which is pluralism, where we want to accentuate diversity for the sake of diversity, which is a little bit closer to the premillennialist position, even though the premillennialists think that the World Council of Churches is, in fact, the enemy. I don't know, maybe there's a fourth position in there as well. Maybe it all hinges on whether or not multiple languages is, in fact, a curse or is it a blessing.
Well, I don't know how far we want to go into those typologies, but don't those premillennialists need not only for there to be diversity, but struggle? At least that's one way I've heard some of this worked out. And in fact, there are people in the United States with a lot of money who are helping to arm Israel privately, thinking that what they're doing will eventually help to bring on Armageddon. And they want a war to start.
That's true, but that's a different part of the premillennialist argument. Premillennialist argument is that God's real business is with the Jews and not with the Christians.
Okay. In any case, part of what you're pointing out to us is there are many different kinds of pluralism. And some of them involve a dialogue and toleration that would allow us to live peacefully with pluralism. Yeah.
Of course, there's also pluralism among people who speak the same language and have the same culture. And it seems to me one of the important lines here is this, when the people say, let us make a name for ourselves. It's always seemed to me it's that sort of hubris that
yes.
is really us concerned, and that the language is a means to get at the hubris.
Yeah.
This is interesting to think about some of the historic things we struggle with as human beings, like the Third Reich and the colonial era, because you always think of that in terms of power and power over each other, but in a way there was the Alexander the Great sort of component to those things too, of making all people the same mm-hmm. in Germany, and then in depriving colonial people of their language and their, and it's interesting in those terms, because we always think of it more in power terms, exerting power over each other, but maybe people had more of this utopian idea than
they give them credit for, which is the cautionary test. Mm-hmm. We're from Canada. It's kind of a different history that we've got with pluralism and sameness than you do. In the United States, you've come through a system where you're a melting pot where everyone becomes an American. And Canadians had a different vision, in that we have a multicultural vision, in that you are Canadian and yet you can retain your cultural ties. And so, you know, it's a whole different idea of what it is to be a member of that country. And we're struggling right now with some of our pluralism too. There are language differences where we have two official languages. It's a different vision.
I think you'd get a little debate on whether this melting pot thing really works. I've heard many people saying that we don't have a melting pot so much as a stew pot. You can still see
the boiling pot in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
A new image that I heard is that, to move this more towards a metaphor of a salad bowl, Each component retains its uniqueness and adds to the play.
And pretty soon we're going to have to decide, though, whether we're going to have public schools in which only Spanish is taught. So we're going to end up with the language problem even in this country.
You better go to school on some of the Canadian problems that they have with the one language in Quebec.
Related to the cultural differences, for example, our children are schooled in French, so that they're bilingual children.
And not in Quebec.
Actions
in Quebec.
Yeah, it's probably more difficult to be bilingual in Quebec than it is in
Brunswick. Yes. New Brunswick, very bilingual, but not Quebec.
Well, let's take a look at what I think Genesis believes is the response to pluralism, which is in chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. Out of all the genealogy of the peoples that follows the Babel story, no particular attention is given to any one family, but suddenly at chapter 12, verse 1, for no apparent reason, God sort of lands upon one couple, as it were, and just says, "You, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great." What was happening in the other part of this was that people were trying to make their own name great. God says, "I will make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the ones who curse you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." Now that's the introduction to the story of the matriarchs and patriarchs, the history of Abraham and Sarah and their offspring, or as we call it, the history of the Israelite people. Genesis 1 to 11 is called the primal history by biblical scholars. The story of where the world came from and why it is the way it is. But it seems to me that Genesis 12, 1 to 3 is a kind of hinge piece between the primal history and the history of the people of Israel, and that it not only functions as the introduction to the story of Abraham and Sarah and their people, but it serves as the conclusion and the last piece of that primal history, because this, to me, seems to be the fourth element that's missing from the Tower of Babel story. In this era of pluralism now, the only hope we have for a world which up to now has been characterized by curse, by disobedience, by murder, by widespread violence, and now by total fragmentation into umpteen language and cultural groups, is if somebody can be an agent of blessing in the world. God, we saw last time in Genesis 8, at the end of the flood story, decides that did not work. Curse did not solve the problem. God nuked everybody but the best handful of folks God could find, and it didn't help. Because immediately upon attempting to start over, they fell into the same old mess. Noah plants his vineyard, gets drunk, and we start over again with shame and curse. And God says, "See, it's just that way. The imagination of their heart is evil from their youth. There's nothing you can do about it. Curse does not work." And so this time...
Fred, just... In 9:24 forward, that Noah gives the curse this time instead of God, or does that not matter?
Yes, it is different in the sense that the cursing that you have going on at that point is, you know, the father cursing one of his sons. Yeah. I just meant to say that some of the same kind of stuff, shame, nakedness, cursing, and so forth, are part of the story immediately after the flood, when all we've got are the best people God could find for starting over. Someone in the last hour is a career naval officer, and he was pointing out that this is a typical drunken sailor story. Get off the boat and head for the booze. Few people are as dangerous, he said, as someone like that. I wouldn't know. Anyway, the way I understand this is Israel's story of how it fits into the larger framework of the world. This is how the Israelites taught their children what it meant to be Israel. We are God's last hope for the world. The world is full of wrongdoing to which God has responded with curse, and it doesn't work. God's last hope of trying to get done in the world what God wants is to try blessing instead of curse. And that's who we are. We are the children of Abram and Sarah, to whom God gave the promise of becoming a people through whom God would work blessing for all the families of the earth, somehow. Which explains all kinds of things, like the understanding that's woven through the entire Old Testament tradition that neither God nor Israel can live without the other. Israel lives with the confidence that God can't give up on them, because if God does, that's the end of God's dream for the world. And so they know God must be faithful to them, so they can pray boldly in ways that only that could allow. And God likewise behaves accordingly. These people are his last hope. God has tied God's fate to them. And if God has to give up on these people, then God's dream is ended. God is common and ordinary. A cursing, punishing God like all the other peoples of the ancient Near East described their gods. And so God and Israel are joined together by this promise of blessing in an exceedingly intimate and tight way. But what does it mean to bring blessing instead of curse? In what way does blessing fix what's wrong with the world? There are a variety of ways to try to get at that, and I want to try out at least three of them with you in the next few minutes and see what you think. The most obvious way would be to simply analyze what it means to bless. What does blessing mean? Or bringing blessing, what does that mean? The verb to bless in Hebrew, barak, the root meaning of the verb is to kneel. And that's its basic kind of rock bottom. That's the picture that the verb conjures up, kneeling. without being able to go back and talk to any ancient Israelites and ask where that word came from. How did that get to be your word for blessing? The closest I can understand or get into it is that it comes from the whole business of people somewhere lower on the authority chain kneeling before their superiors in a position that makes them vulnerable to the other party, because kneeling you can't run away very fast, and you have to take whatever it is the other person is going to give you in the way of a response to your arrival. And when you come and kneel before someone, they may chop your head off with a sword, they may hit you in the face, they may spit on you, or they may give you $1 million, a stroke on the cheek, a kiss on the head. You don't know, but if you kneel before someone, you're there to take whatever it is they'll give you. So to be a kneeler is to be a receiver. So to bless someone, you know, could mean kneeling before them so as to be in the position of being vulnerable to them and be a receiver of whatever it is they have to give you. And they might hit you in the face, but they also might greet you warmly, give you something wonderful. Hebrew verbs can also be used in causative, reflexive, and intensified ways, so that blessing can also be understood as putting oneself in the position that you are the stander and the other is a kneeler. And therefore the other is vulnerable to you, and you may either smack them or grace them in some way or another. So that's the root meaning of the verb. It's got to do with giving and receiving, kneeling or being knelt before, and the giving and receiving of either good things or mistreatment. And I would presume that since what we're trying to do is work good things in the earth, what we're trying to get flowing between the kneelers and the standers is, you know, positive gifts rather than mistreatment. So at a sort of base level, that's what being involved in blessing is all about. A Jewish reading would be that the way this blessing gets worked out is when God gives to this people, who are God's agents of blessing, the Torah. And by means of the Torah and following it, people are able to work in the world what God really wants done, and draw other people into doing that same thing. And so the world will be blessed, the world will be given what God wants given to it if people worship only God, if people keep a Sabbath, that is, they leave off at least one day a week from trying to change the world and simply receive it as God's gracious gift. Life and everything that we have, we receive as God's gift. Resting and enjoying it like God did. The world will be blessed if we really do honor our fathers and mothers, if we don't kill, if we don't mess with each other's spouses, if we don't steal, if we tell the truth when it counts, and if we can find a way to do something about coveting. If we could do that, wouldn't the world be a whole lot better? Which means for one thing, that the line that a lot of us were taught, that Judaism is a religion of works righteousness in which you attempt to earn God's favor by keeping the commandments, is a bunch of baloney. And you have the commandments and you try to keep them not so as to become one of God's people, but because you are. It's the job description. Now, you are my person. You are my agent of blessing. You are my last hope. I know I am tied to you forever. No longer can I do without you. But here's the program. This is what we're trying. So that's another thing that it can mean. Now let me offer a third one and see what you think of this. This is more my own. One of the clues that I often use when studying any story or group of stories is names that are spelled out as symbolic. And it so happens that there's a whole line of names about to come up in the story of this people, which are told to us flat out, these are symbolic names. Pay attention to what they mean. Lots of stories do this, and you're supposed to then know what the names mean because they help you understand. Last week, some of us were doing some work with Ruth, which is one of those stories written in a time when foreign women were banned from the community in the reforms of Ezra and Nehemiah. An edict was made that henceforth and forevermore you shall have no non-Israelite wives, and you must divorce all the ones you have and send them away along with all the children you had by them. And so you have this terrible, sad scene at the end of Ezra in which all these women are sent away and their children, no more non-Israelite spouses. You know, whether you love them or not, it doesn't make any difference. And then the book of Ruth was written in response to that, and the clue that the names are important is given us flat out. Because Naomi, whose name means pleasantness, says, don't call me that anymore, because things are not pleasant any longer. Call me bitter. Call me Mara. There's a clue. Names mean something here, and if you check them out, all the names mean something. Naomi has two daughters-in-law, one of whom is named Friendship, and the other of whom is named Back of the Neck. Ruth and Orpah. Because Ruth was a friend who said, your people will be my people. Where you go, I will go. Where you die, I will die. Where you're buried, I will be buried. Orpah, the last thing she saw of her was the back of her neck. Because she asked her to go, not because she was not a good person. And so this Moabite woman who is a friend of Israel comes back to the homeland, and she ends up in the house of a man named Boaz. Boaz is an expression that is found, has been found by archaeologists on the doorposts of homes that have been dug up. On one post it says Bo, and on the other it says Az, means in strength. It's part of the building code. It's like the signs on the elevators that say capacity 600 pound, or not 600, 6,000 pounds, or 30 people. Please don't calculate that out. That was what they put on a home to assure you that when the earthquakes came, it wouldn't fall down on you. It was built Boaz in strength. It'll stand. Ruth ends up in a home that's Boaz. So Ezra, you get a woman who's a friend of Israel in here, the house is not going to come down. So the names tell the story. The children of Abraham and Sarah, or at least the first three males who get into the birthright line after Abraham and Sarah, all have names whose meanings are very carefully spelled out. And I want to trot them past you and see if maybe they don't represent a possibility for working blessing in the world. The first of them is Isaac. Probably most of you or many of you know what Isaac means. It's one of those onomatopoetic words in Hebrew. It means laughter. Hip-hop. It's a little guttural laugh. I guess you had to be there. Yitzhak means laughter, and he's named that because when the three visitors come in Genesis 18 to the tent of Abraham and Sarah, and they are treated hospitably and then say, "We'll be back again by spring, at which point your wife Sarah will be with child." And eyebrows get raised around the place because, as the narrator says, Abraham and Sarah were very old, and it had long since ceased to be for Sarah in the way of women. And so Sarah's inside the tent, and she laughs. And the visitors say, "Why did your wife laugh? This is really going to happen." And so the usual interpretation is that this is a laugh of incredulity, of disbelief, and she shouldn't have laughed. But later on, when the child is born in chapter 21 and the name is given, Sarah says, not, "I'm going to name the kid Yitzhak because I was laughing in the tent." She says, "The child's name shall be Isaac because my barrenness is gone, and the whole world will laugh." So, the first child is laughter. Isaac's son, who carries on the birthright line, is Jacob, who gets a new name. Jacob means he tries to beat people. Literally, it means he cheats, which he does. But he gets a new name, and that's the name that sticks for the people. Again, it's a, at least potentially unflattering circumstance that Jacob is in. He's coming back home after his exile in flight from Esau, from whom he has stolen the birthright, and he flees Esau's anger. He's about to come home now after having been away a long time and having a family and becoming wealthy, but he's still afraid of Esau, and he knows that the next day he will meet Esau. And so he sends all his wives and children across the river into the territory where he's going to meet Esau while he stays back on this side of the river to spend the night. Maybe an uncharitable reading is that he wants to see whether they get slaughtered, and if he does, he can still run away. If you want to put the best construction on things, you can maybe think of another motive. In any case, while he's back there wondering how things will turn out the next day, he is accosted by this night stranger who is variously identified as a man and an angel and God, all in the same story. At the end of the all-night struggle, and the sun is coming up, and the stranger says, "Let me go," and Jacob says, "Not until you bless me," and the wrestling partner blesses him, says, "Your name now will not be Jacob, but Israel, because you have fought with God and with humankind, and you have prevailed." And then he knees him in the groin and leaves. So that Jacob leaves the scene limping for good and with a new name. He's now Israel, the one who fights with God. That's what Israel means, he who fights with God. And he walks in a different way than he used to walk. the next child, who carries on in the birthright line, also has a very important and significant name. Would you turn, please, to Genesis 29? Jacob falls in love with Rachel, works 7 years for her hand. On the wedding night, Laban tricks Jacob and slips Leah into the tent. And for reasons I'll never understand, Jacob doesn't catch on until the next morning. Which I guess means he didn't talk to her. I don't understand that. But in any case, he has to work more for his beloved in the meantime. He does have Leah and Rachel as his wives, and he loves Rachel, and evidently does not love Leah. And it's not Leah's fault. This was not her idea to be shoved in the tent because of the family customs. So verse 31. When the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Leah conceived and bore a son, and she named him Reuben, for she said, because the Lord has looked on my affliction. Reuben means, look, a son, which normally would have endeared a wife to her husband. Look, I bore you a son. Is it okay now? But it wasn't. She conceived again and bore a son and said, because the Lord has heard that I am hated, he has given me this son also. Simeon means he has heard. So she named him Simeon. Again she conceived and bore a son and said, now this time my husband will be joined to me because I have borne him 3 sons. And so she named him joined Levi. But I guess it didn't work. All this woman wanted was finally for this man to love her. That's all she wanted. He kept sleeping with her. She kept having babies by him. But he didn't love her. That's all she wanted. So a fourth time, she conceives and bore a son. This time, she says something that's got nothing to do with Jacob. She says, this time, I will praise the Lord. So she named him Judah, which means, oh, give thanks. It's the word that begins all those psalm verses. Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good. Actually, the verb yada, its base meaning is to throw your hands up, or actually to throw something in the air. Which is why, to this day, when you say the prayer of thanksgiving, you throw your hands up. That's the gesture of giving thanks. And that's the child that gets the birthright line, that gets into the birthright line, and that's the child who, after Israel, the people are named for. The people of Judah, the people of Oh Give Thanks. Now think about that. How's that for a program of bringing blessing into the earth? Now, who are we? We are the people who laugh, who wrestle with God, and give thanks. Now, if we can rejoice, if we can let our real battles be with God and not with our neighbors and brothers and sisters, and really go face to face with God, really talk to God the way they did in the Psalms, and say, now come on, God, what's the skinny here? And if we can give thanks, if we really could keep Sabbath and accept the world as a gift and life as a gift, you know, couldn't the world be different if that's who we really were? The laughers, the wrestlers, and the givers of thanks. I kind of wonder if maybe that isn't a way that Genesis envisions a new world or a possibility toward that. So I don't know. What do you think? Does that make any sense? Or sounds a little dreamy and homiletical in a certain way, but it is in another way. It's just very practical. I mean, it's three simple things.
What happens if you go on in the line?
Well, you get to a really crazy but wonderful story. You get the twins, Perah and Zerah, who are born to Judah's daughter-in-law, Tamar, who, this is a great story, Genesis 38, you know. Judah's two sons take daughters, and the first son God didn't like, his name was Ur, so God slew him, and his wife Tamar was left widowed, and so she was supposed to be taken by Judah's son Onan, who knew that if he went by the law of levirate marriage and raised up a child with Tamar, it would be his rival for the birthright, because it would be Ur's heir. And so he spilled his seed on the ground, and God slew him. And so then Judah says, "Well, I'm not sure I want to give you another kid, you know. My sons keep dying when you're married. So you wait. I have this little boy that you can have, you know, if you just hang around." And so she waits, and finally he comes of age. He gives the boy to someone else, and she's left without anyone. And so she decides to go where he's out shearing sheep and play the prostitute. And I mean, that's where the offspring come from. That's the rest of the story is as long as I'm telling it, I guess I'll finish. You know, he goes to her and he says, "You know, lie with me." And she says, "What do you give me?" And he says, "A kid from my flock, only I don't have it with me. Do you take MasterCard?" And she says, "Well, yeah, I'll take a signet ring in your staff. That'll do." So he gives that to her. And they lie together and he leaves. And she packs up and goes back home. He goes to a servant and says, "Take a kid from one of the flocks, go pay the prostitute." So he takes a kid, goes to find there's nobody there. You know, he's trying to pay a prostitute, and so he's got to go around asking, "Have you seen the prostitute? I need to pay her." You know, and they're going, "There's no prostitute here. What are you talking about?" So he gets a little embarrassed at this and finally goes back and says, "She's not there." So they try to forget about it. 3 months later, Judah is told, "Your daughter-in-law is pregnant without benefit of husband. What do you think of that?" Terrible. "Bring her out here to the city gates. She should be stoned to death." So they're just about to stone her to death for getting pregnant under those circumstances. And she says, "I can tell you who the father is. It's whoever belongs to the signet ring." And Judah says, "Oh my goodness, you are more righteous than I." And he took her as wife, and she bears these twins, Perez and Zerah. The birthright thing you start losing track of in the Old Testament at this point, but they get into the genealogy of Jesus. They are mentioned in Matthew 1 in the genealogy of Jesus. So I've never tried to follow the name of Perez, the older of the two, is given to, you know, there's a meaning given to it, but I've never tried to get them into this vision of a program for a new world.
Well, three is enough, right? Mm-hmm.
That's right, that's Lutheran. Well, it is 10, it's actually a little after 10, so maybe we should wrap it up for now. We did not get to on this mountain. Maybe we'll briefly do on this mountain tomorrow before getting to the temptation of Jesus, which is the next next major vision beyond the Old Testament for a new world.